The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world. Peace on Earth, or is it going to be Earth in pieces? Oh, we continually parrot the shop-worn old phrases at this time of the year especially. You can hear the monotonous clinking and dinging of the bells all over the streets of America's cities. You can look at all the accoutrements and paraphernalia of Christmas season, what is called Yuletide, and no one knows what that means. You can see the holly wreath, the mistletoe, the trees, the bulbs, the orbs, all of the bright decorations. The trees are up for sale, the metallic ones at last. Especially they're important for people in Australia, South Africa, and other parts of the Western Hemisphere where people might observe the ancient Roman ceremony. Because you see, in that part of the world, it's in the middle of a summer heat wave, and so it's not necessarily a good idea to take a young fir tree, which doesn't exist in a lot of those places anyway, and take it indoors because it's going to dry up. Might be quite a fire crisis. Well, they're not available, so they use the metal ones. This whole thing of Christmas observance gets a little bit jaded, just a little bit monotonous, just a little bit out of character, it seems, and out of step with the realities of this nuclear-armed world in which we live. It's as if, just like the frenzy of the Thanksgiving weekend football viewing, we're all able to take time out from the worries and the concerns of the shocking time in which we live, to bury our minds in a frantic search for pleasure, of materialism, of visiting the glittering shelves of our major department stores and shopping centers as we busily go about bustling through our list of Christmas gifts and go to the bank and draw out all of our savings that we have put away in the Christmas savings plan since last year. And we're hooked. We're like a drug addict, like on a narcotic kick. We can't seem to get off it. Now, by the thousands, the tens of thousands of people complain. They don't like it. They resent it. They're sending cards by the bushels and clogging the mails to people they don't know, people they have long since forgotten, as well as a few choice friends, perhaps, they have on the list there. But how many times have you heard clerks, people shopping, waitresses in restaurants, people standing on a street corner in a chilly, blizzard-like day trying to rush to get the last bit of shopping done, people jammed in interminable lines of impossible, snarled traffic jams in their automobiles, who are enervated, who are impatient, turned off, upset, exhausted, spending money on presents people don't need, can't use, and will soon wear out, shouldn't have, and probably can't afford. And it's all a gigantic commercial binge that is known as a Christian holiday. I look at it from the perspective of the major religions of the world for a moment, and also from the perspective of history. No such phenomenon occurs in the nation of India, of China, of Russia, of much of the rest of Africa, of the Polynesian, Melanesian, Micronesian islands, except in some areas where Christian missionaries have implanted the concept. It's a little difficult to sing of a white Christmas when you're down in blistering 102 or 3 degree temperatures with the asphalt melting in the streets in some major city of Australia on December 25th. What is known about the origin of Christmas? Did you know that Christmas was, now listen carefully to this next statement, you might miss it. Did you know that Christmas was celebrated thousands of years before Christ? You know, a lot of people don't know that. But you can look it up in encyclopedias and history books just on the subject of Christmas. All you need is the word Christmas and simply look it up. Now, I could give you a couple of other words if you'd like, just to look it up in an encyclopedia, in your local library, or if that's too much difficulty, maybe send somebody else on an errand, or maybe even call a librarian. Maybe they got somebody in a reference department that would help you by just reading it to you over the telephone. Look up the word Saturnalia. Saturn, and then A-L-I-A on the end of it. Saturnalia. Find out what that's got to do with the celebration of Christmas time. Look up the word Brumalia. B-R-U-M-A-L-I-A. And find out what those festivals were. A lot of people don't seem to realize that the ancient pagan Greeks, Romans, Babylonians, Persians, and others celebrated ceremonies just about exactly like our modern Christmas Day, with two or three minor little changes along the way. They had orbs, round orbs of all types and descriptions. Some of them looked like eggs with snakes wrapped around them. They had the idea of a tree that sprang out of the dead trunk of a log that had been dismembered or severed from the forest. But in those days, it was all the celebration of the original Madonna and Child, which was a pagan substitution that came along to supplant the idea of the actual Messiah who was to come to the earth. And this was done through satanic subtlety thousands of years, centuries and centuries before the time of Jesus Christ. There was an ancient Babylonian high priestess who was called Semiramis. Some pronounce it Semiramis. Her name is perpetuated to the point that there is a hotel called the Semiramis, and there is a cruise ship on the Nile River today, in this modern day, in Egypt, named by the same name. That name is well known in the Middle East. A lot of hunting clubs in the United States are called by the name of her apparently son and yet consort, Nimrod. Nimrod was an ancient Babylonian. This, now, I don't mean that he was ancient, he was just a young kid, you know, when a lot of this was happening, a young man, but I mean it goes way, way back, centuries and centuries ago. Nimrod was supposed to have been a mighty hunter. But between the two of them, a religion was concocted, and as the years went by, they became revered symbols of an ancient pagan religion. There was a mythical story about a resurrection. There was a mythical story about a Madonna and Child. There was the story about the perpetuation of life through various pagan ceremonies that later were found in other religions and finally even became so-called Christianized in the mid-ages of our modern civilization, or what led to modern civilization. They had all of the beliefs, all the superstitions of many another pagan tribe about where life came from, what perpetuated life, what was important to living things on the earth, such as the sun, the moon, the tide, stars, the orbital pattern of the earth, the seasons and the like, winter, spring, and fall. They knew that life came from seeds that were planted in the ground. They knew that all life came from a seed of one kind or another, even human life. And so they worshiped the symbol of that life. And so seeds, grain, all types of seeds, and especially eggs, became symbolic of fertility and of life. The egg was even in an ancient myth about the survival of man in a mythological flood, where it was assumed that instead of an ark during the time of Noah, that all of humankind was in an egg that emerged from storm-tossed waters. They could see, as most farm kids can, growing up on a farm, whether you're talking about anything from turtles to snakes to ducks to chickens, that life will peck its way or somehow force its way out of a decaying shell of an egg. And as they saw a little chicken peck its way out of an egg, and they saw the little fluffy thing begin to stagger around and gain its feet, it was a marvelous miracle to the pagans. A never-ceasing area for exclamation, for wonder, for marvel. So eggs played a very important part in some of the pagan sex ceremonies. They were sex symbols of both male and female. And they were hung on trees. And they became part of the decoration of many of the public buildings of that time. Now, strangely enough, even in some of the friezes, the frieze, you know, is the decorative type of like a molding around the very bottom of maybe an eave or the overhanging part of an arch or of a roof of a building that is a decorative strip of a maybe series of leaves or acorns, or like as not, eggs. You can see to this day in European buildings, and you can see especially in church and religious type buildings all throughout the Mediterranean area, Europe, and even the United States, series of eggs in relief, maybe a bas relief of half of an egg. We perpetuate that in the Christmas and the Easter season, even today, of the use of ancient pagan sex symbols. A mistletoe has a sex connotation. While it's a parasite and blossoms out with its kind of sticky, slightly oval or egg-shaped little white berries, it is nevertheless sucking the life out of many a huge oak tree and other hardwoods throughout the forests of the entirety of the United States and very widely spread. It's a parasite, that some type of a fable began to derive from the use of that parasite at Christmas time, and so to this day, people perpetuate it by hanging mistletoe under their doorways and in various strategic places around the house so that over the Tom and Jerry bowl, they can maybe sneak a kiss to the neighbor's wife in the kitchen. And this is done quite commonly, but no one knows why. It's a quaint custom, it's cute, it's fun, a lot of people enjoy it. It's really great to come into your neighbor's house and everybody is kind of singing it up and gathering around the piano, maybe singing a few carols or watching a television football game or a basketball game, drinking eggnogs and really hooping it up, and maybe once in a while just kind of happening to time your passing back and forth from the kitchen to get another one with the neighbor's wife so you can stand under the mistletoe. But no one knows why they do it. Now, the holly wreath had quite a symbolism, and the red berries on the holly were a symbolic type of thing, too. The fact that the wreath was in a circular form was quite symbolic. Most people don't know what in the world a Yule log is. They don't know the meaning of the word Yule, except Brenner, and they know him as a movie star. But other than that, Yule doesn't mean anything, except maybe the Southern people that say, are Yule ready to go? No, are y'all ready to go? But what is Yule tide? Is that a high tide? I mean, the other day there was a big earthquake and a lot of people suffered and some people died and were injured and property damaged over in the island of Hawaii. What is Yule tide? Is that a tide that happens on an island called Yule? You know, it's astonishing that people don't know what they're doing. I like to ask, what are the origins of things? Where did we get what we believe? Why do we do what we do? Why do we accept casually, with no question whatsoever, customs that cost us like mad? That really sock us a tremendous, shocking jolt in the wallet and the pocketbook, and we're hung up on it, and we can't get off the bandwagon, and we keep doing it because we feel we'd be blackballed and cussed out and otherwise ejected and rejected from society if we quit doing it. And yet everybody whispers about it and argues about it and bickers about it and complains about it. People in banks drawing out their savings, it's really killing me this Christmas season. The shopkeepers, when you look at shoplifting, tis the season to be shoplifting. One out of every nine Americans through the standard part of the year is a shoplifter, either full-time or part-time. One out of nine shoppers. And probably several of the rest of that nine are about to be, wish they could be, or would be if they didn't think there was a chance of getting caught. But what really turns off the big businesses is the white-collar thief, especially at Christmas time. Because thousands of stores have to hire thousands of part-time workers. And so they hire housewives, divorcees, high school and college kids out for the vacation, whatnot, part-time workers that come in droves to handle the massive influx of Christmas shoppers. And because of the crowds in the store, it's a lot more difficult for security systems, for plainclothes guards, for all the mirrors and the closed-circuit TV and everything else to keep up with it. But what most of these department store owners know, what they expect, what they have to more or less just prepare for, is that a lot of those goods go out the back door, not necessarily the front door, and that the people who are stealing them blind, or often as not, part-time or full-time employees of the store. Now, I'm telling you the truth. I'm telling you what major businesses know and what they have to build into their budgets as they raise prices to offset so as to pass on to the consumer the tremendous loss they must take every Christmas season because of pilferage. It's a time when the disparity between rich and poor is more glaringly apparent than any other part of the year. Therefore, it's a time of very deep despair, of heavy moroseness, of frustration and anxiety, and a time, believe it or not, in the 24-hour period for quite a number of years, this has been true, between Christmas Eve and the following midnight, is one of the highest suicide rates in the United States. That people kill themselves. Now, why is this? Well, on the one hand, you have the 11-plus million now unemployed in the United States. Now, maybe it makes sense to you that during a time when we're in the combined vice, which has us in its grip of stagflation, which is the stagnation of our industrial output, though there was a slight upswing. Now we're hearing some serious rumblings about another downturn in the economy, so that we have soaring inflation and at the same time business recession, called stagflation, a word that was coined by economists not long ago. 11 million plus out of work. More people out of work in the Western societies of the democratic industrialized West now than at any time than that terrible dark era that led directly into World War II. And we're reliving that time, yet right at this season of the year, everybody goes on a gigantic spending binge. And the economy depends upon it. Let me tell you that the literature I announce, the Good News magazine, I want to talk to you about the book that I've got for you on the subject of Christmas and the real Jesus, made really much of a serious inroad into this Christmas practice and belief. It would actually hurt the economy, I imagine. I don't expect it to, because I've said things like this year after year, and one out of a million every now and then decide to go to a public library. But I don't really kid myself that more than one out of a million is going to do that. People just don't take up that kind of a challenge. They're not that interested. They couldn't care less. They're kind of hooked on it. It's a part of what they do. It's all involved in family, society, friends, and lodges and clubs, and kind of a calendar of events they're looking forward to. They're pretty much involved in it, so why get off the merry-go-round? The thing is speeding up, going faster all the time. They might get hurt if they stepped off at that speed. So they simply keep on doing what they're doing, with the boxes of candy and nuts, the Christmas tree, the stockings, the children, all the monotonous songs, and old Bing is still singing, "I'm dreaming of a white Christmas." And so we just keep it up year after year after year, but we take it for granted. And we don't look it up. We don't find out what are its origins. Where did all these accoutrements of Christmas come from? How can you look it up? How can you find out? Well, you can write for a book that I've got for you on the plain truth about Christmas, on whether we got it from the Bible or paganism, the origin of Santa Claus, just who in the world he is, why he is the predominant figure in Christmas instead of Christ, and that's supposed to be in honor of Christ's birthday. But most little kids don't want to go see Jesus someplace. They want to go see Santa. So you got thousands and thousands of department store Santa Clauses. You can see two in one store, or four or five, depending on the floor you go into, and six or eight across the street. This must be altogether confusing and bewildering to many children. But when you're a little kid, you couldn't care less. And every time I go on like this on the radio, I get some hate mail from some mothers who are so absolutely anxious to perpetuate the myth that they really just give me fits for having been overheard by their kid on the living room floor. Now, they can watch Tom and Jerry blow each other to bits. They can watch the Roadrunner cartoons. They can watch the Three Stooges. They can watch violence unparalleled in comedies and cartoons. They can go read their comic books. They can go down to a drugstore and see every kind of pornography that would have blown the toupee right off of Grandpa and just about shocked Grandmother out of her sunbonnet. But if I say anything about Santa Claus, I have just about attacked the statue of Abraham Lincoln along the Potomac. I have just about done violence to the Washington Monument. By the way, somebody ought to look into the origin of that shape. That's another subject. Anyway, why don't you look it up? You don't really need this booklet. I'd like you to write for it. If you'd like it, you can have it free of charge. We'll send you the booklet, then you'll have something to go on to do further research, including this magazine called The Good News, which discusses the pagan calendar, how the years are wrong, and whether or not Christ was born B.C. Now, that's a head-scratcher, isn't it? How could Christ have been born before Christ? Believe it or not, he was. Jesus was born 4 years before Christ. I'm not kidding you. Now, please, don't assume that the whole world got news, you know, through a combination of satellite, global telecommunications, maybe instant replay on television, of the birth of Jesus Christ. So Chinese, Japanese, people that inhabited in those days the islands of Australia, the Aboriginal tribes, people in this hemisphere, all instantly said, hey, Jesus was born the other day, so now it is 1 A.D. changing from 1 B.C., and so now it's 1 A.D. No, actually, that isn't the way it happened. The biblical facts clearly show that Jesus Christ of Nazareth was not born on or anywhere near December 25th, and that he was actually born 4 B.C. in the autumn. How could he have been born before Christ? If you write for this magazine called The Good News, you can find out. You know, a lot of people take a lot of things for granted out of ancient history. We just seem to assume, since it's done around us, other people are doing it, we're all caught up in it, and it's got to be right. It's got to be good for us. I think you all know the Jewish calendar is different from the so-called Christian, which came out of the Roman period. I think you all know that the Muslim or the religion of Islam people count their time differently, that they reckon from what was called the Hijra, the flight of Muhammad from Mecca to Medina. And so there is the Christian calendar. The Chinese count differently than we do, have a different New Year. So do the Jews, so do other religions, and so on. But did you ever analyze where all of these practices came from? Did you ever find out exactly how the ABBC thing got started? That wasn't an instruction from God. It actually was established by a fellow called Dionysius the Little. Won't go into that name, but he was a Roman Catholic who lived in the 6th century. And he began to figure about how to do something with a calendar. That calendar that he worked on, he was an abbot, it was used in only a few parts of Italy. It didn't even reach France until the 8th century. The Florentines continued to use a totally different method of reckoning the passage of years, even until as late as the 18th century. And a lot of other different peoples in different locales with different religions began their years on different dates and in different months. So it was Dionysius the Little who began assigning the years prior to Christ as those that he called in Latin ante Christum, in English, before Christ. AC in Latin, and BC in our English. And so those who followed that idea of reckoning thought that the first year of his birth was Anno Domini, or the year of our Lord. Now his method of dividing the years with the supposed time of the birth of Christ has led to all types of difficulties. For example, they don't insert any year zero, which would be designated zero. There wasn't any such year, but if they would, it would make you conscious of the fact that counting either way, backward or forward, across AD and BC, that you would have to add one, because you've got BC 1, 2, 3, and you've got AD 1, 2, 3. So you've got two digits of one. If you had a year zero there, which would be ridiculous, you would at least be conscious of the fact that there were two digits one. But you're not conscious of that, so most people omit it, including even Usher's famous chronology, and including some of the most reputable Bible handbooks in some of the libraries of great theological institutions in their counting back and forth with regard to prophetic and historic dates. They omit the fact that they ought to add 1 year because they have a 1 BC and a 1 AD. If you want to write for the current number of the Good News magazine, there's an article entitled, Millions Don't Know the Real Jesus Christ of Nazareth, Do You? And that article has a lot of questions in it, and it also answers a lot of questions on whether Jesus was born in a house or a manger. He was in a house when the Magi got there. How many Magi were there? How long did it take? When was he born? What are the proofs? You know that even our years, our days, and our months are pagan, and they are actually in error. When you look into it, you'll find out with a gasp of amazement, a lot of the things that you take for granted every single day to make up a part of your daily way of life had their origins in ancient Babylon, Greece, Rome, and Egypt. And it's quite a revelation when you discover some of those things. This booklet on the plain truth about Christmas goes into the entire subject from an historical as well as a biblical point of view. It shows you a picture of one of the original Madonnas and child. And this comes all the way from Semiramis and her son, a rare Egyptian sculpture. And this time, the son was named Horus among the Egyptians. And yet, as I mentioned, Nimrod is a name that was perpetuated by the Babylonians, and there was a type of a mother and a child all thousands of years before Jesus Christ. What do the encyclopedias say? Well, let me give you a couple of quotes that you'll get in this booklet. This is in the Catholic Encyclopedia under the article Christmas. Quote, Christmas was not among the earliest festivals of the church. The first evidence of the feast is from Egypt. Pagan customs centering around the January calends gravitated to Christmas, end quote. That's out of the Catholic Encyclopedia, an admission that it predated the birth of Christ, that it came from Egypt, not even from Rome or from Germany or somewhere else. Under the heading Natal Day, you can find that the early Catholic father, as he was called, or Origen, acknowledged that. He said, and I quote in the scriptures, no one is recorded to have kept a feast or held a great banquet on his, that's Christ's birthday. It is only sinners like Pharaoh and Herod, and make great rejoicings over the day in which they were born into this world. The Encyclopedia Britannica says, and I quote, Christmas, in other words, the Mass of Christ, Christmas was not among the earliest festivals of the Church. It was not instituted by Christ or the Apostles or by Bible authority. It was picked up afterward from paganism. The Encyclopedia Americana says, and I quote, Christmas was, according to many authorities, not celebrated in the first centuries of the Christian Church, as the Christian usage in general was to celebrate the death of remarkable persons rather than their birth. That's interesting, isn't it, out of some of these historical authorities. Jesus wasn't born in the winter season. When he was born, there were in the fields shepherds staying out there and keeping watch over their flocks by night. You can find even from Adam Clark's commentary a statement of how it was a custom among the Jews of those days to send the sheep to the fields and deserts about the Passover and bring them home at the commencement of the first rain, which would take place much, much earlier than December 25th, by at least 2.5, maybe 3 or more months. You can ask for a reprint, too, on when was Christ born. Well, how did that custom get into the Church? There's a quote from the new Schaff-Herzog Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge in the booklet that says in its article on Christmas, and I quote, how much the date of the festival depended upon the pagan Brumalia, that was on December 25th, following the Saturnalia that took place on December 17th through the 24th, and celebrating the shortest day of the year and the new sun, cannot be accurately determined. The pagan Saturnalia and Brumalia were too deeply entrenched in popular custom to be set aside by Christian influence. The pagan festival, with its riot and merrymaking, was so popular that Christians were glad of an excuse to continue its celebration with little change in spirit and in manner. Christian preachers of the West and the Near East protested against the unseemly frivolity with which Christ's birthday was celebrated, while Christians of Mesopotamia accused their Western brethren of idolatry and sun worship for adopting as Christian this pagan festival. From the Schaff-Herzog Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge, on the article, Christmas. Shocking, isn't it, when you hear some of those authorities out of ancient history tell you a little bit about the origin of Christmas? The real origin is given in this booklet, as well as questions and answers about the origin of the holly wreath, mistletoe, the Yule log, Santa Claus, and what the Bible says about the Christmas tree. The Good News Magazine, this neat article, A War That Could End It All, the article on the real Jesus, articles of a biblical nature such as the one, What Is Sin? Give us this day our daily bread, the wave sheaf ritual, a path to living faith. In vain do they worship me, therapy for ailing marriages. God loves a cheerful giver, how to really understand the Bible. Those are articles in past issues of the Good News, the type of material you get every single month in the Good News full color, fully illustrated, free of charge. And be sure to request the current number of the Plain Truth. It comes free of charge with up-to-the-moment articles in the light of today's world news in Bible prophecy. Specific articles getting technically and intricately into what the Bible says about today's unbelievable world news. Every single day as you look at the incredible march of world events, the economic blight spreading over Europe, the deep problem following the Yom Kippur War and the soaring Arab oil prices, runaway inflation, and deepening depression in parts of the world, or recession at least, and maybe headed toward depression, and we need to understand whether or not that is going to happen in the light of Bible prophecy. The Plain Truth deals with these things. Remember, there's absolutely no request for money. It is free. It's gratis to you. The address again is Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, brought to you by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your request along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales.